during this retreat, I've, as you are well aware of, I've been emphasizing over and over again an attitude of mind, which is an attitude of mindfulness and using wisdom to see things as they are. So this, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the refuge in the Buddha, in the Dhamma and the Sangha. Now these, we repeat them over and over just to internalize them, that these, it's important in any religious convention to not just keep it on a kind of exoteric plane, but external. It becomes sterile and has no spirit or life to it if religious convention is only left as a kind of, as a convention alone. It has no vitality of its own, in other words. It's another convention. And the spirit of any religion is your spirit. It's not, it doesn't have its own spirit. It is a form in which you breathe life into the form. It's your spirit that fills out the convention, gives it life. So when we're expecting, say, any religious convention to kind of zap us and inspire us and to fill us up with love and inspiration, then we're asking it to do something it's not capable of doing, because we're really talking to something that depends very much to be on the way we use it. It has no life force of its own. So like Theravada Buddhism can be just a merely kind of passive, spiritless, dead convention where you go through the ceremonies and say, Bhutang Saranang Gacchami, Tamang Saranang Gacchami, then you bow down, bang, 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 and then up, and then you have still a kind of, you have maybe a kind of belief that if you keep doing that, that the spirit of Theravada will suddenly enter your soul. But that's a superstition, really. You're taking something, a belief, you're projecting onto a convention something, you're expecting it to do something for you. You still believe the symbols, the forms, the conventions, the language, the beliefs, all have a power to do something to you, to enlighten you or liberate you or save you. So that is what we call a kind of exoterism, where religious conventions remain only as external things, conventions alone. So when religion degenerates to that, then it becomes dreary and boring, and it's kept alive just by people's kind of belief, that the using of it as a kind of maybe a tradition or cultural tradition. One can see that, say, in England with the Church of England, so much of it is rather, it was without any spirit. I mean, there are people within the Church of England who have the spirit, but as a form in general, I think when you ask English people what religion they've been raised with, they'll say, "Oh, I guess C of E." It's kind of, we went to church on Easter or something like that, like Venerable Ambrose said. So, anyway, it's kept as a kind of cultural heritage. It's part of British culture, English culture. So, it's kind of kept going as a convention, but then people condemn it and complain about it, criticize it, because they say it doesn't have any spirit, it's dreary. They make fun of it. In England, even the Church of England people make fun of the Church of England. in Thailand, a lot of the Buddhism in Thailand is the same way. It's not because of Christianity or any other. It's just that religion easily becomes the established tradition, and then people don't really internalize the conventions. It remains merely a thing you go through as a ceremony, external ceremony. But it doesn't reach your heart. It doesn't. Your spirit is not in it. You do it because it's the proper thing to be doing, or it's what's expected of you. But it's not something, it's not from real understanding and from a real inspiration. Now, the word spirit is an important word, isn't it? Because we have words like inspiration and aspiration and the spirits. We have expiration, desperation. But this is all about the kind of the invisible force, the energy of life, a spirit. And people, if you say a person has spirit, that means they somehow they're alive, they're aware, they have a brightness to them. When a person loses their spirit, they become dreary and dull. The light goes out of their eyes, and they're just kind of going along like a dead convention. They're still breathing, and they still eat and sleep and so forth, but the spirit is no longer operating through the form, so it's a dead kind of form. It just keeps going on what's left of its karma. It doesn't have any vitality to it. Superstition, we want things from outside to come and save us. External forces, or a benevolent being from above, or we're waiting and expecting something somewhere, hoping that we will be given something from above, from outside ourselves. So this tendency to always be looking externally, waiting for something, wanting something, longing for union, longing for fulfillment, and expecting somebody else to come and fulfill you, waiting for Cinderella, waiting for Prince Charming, or the perfect match, the mate that was, the marriage that was meant to be arranged by God up in heaven, the perfect union where the man and woman live happily ever after. This kind of longing for union, unity, oneness, happiness, harmony, and expecting it somebody else to do it for you, or a convention to come along and fulfill you, or another person, or a teacher, or whatever. And when you don't, when it doesn't happen, then we become disappointed and disillusioned with either the person, the people, or the convention. People get interested in Buddhism, and but they also become disinterested in it when it doesn't give them what they want, when it doesn't give you what you want, when it doesn't fulfill you the way you want it to. So then you get disillusioned with Buddhism, then you might go on to another one, just like the kind of Casanova of religion. Hoping the next one will be the right match, the perfect marriage arranged in heaven by God. But that, just that basic assumption and attitude, of course, is wrong. I mean, we're never going to be fulfilled. We're always going to be left alone, and we're always going to be disillusioned and disappointed with everything, as long as that basic delusion is our point of operation, what we come from, how we tend to approach life. So in meditation, we're having the courage to really look at that. Look at that very thing, that longing, that inner longing for union, loneliness, and fear of being left alone, fear of death, fear of the unknown is wanting, you know, and that very fear is a driving force in the human heart, in which we will try anything, seek anything to have even a measure of some kind of fulfillment. So I mean, like alcohol has an effect on the mind in which we might not feel so that kind of gnawing ache or in the guts, that longing for union, or the fear that we have in regards to being left alone in the dark in a mysterious universe, alienated rather than united and one. Or we take drugs, and these things are kind of momentary escapes from that fear. But that's the best they can do. Drugs can't fulfill you, and alcohol can't fulfill you. You'll end up feeling disillusioned, disappointed with that, and any other like. Not only are there alcoholics, there. The modern term is workaholics. How many of you are addicted to work as a kind of keeping busy, doing things, as a way of not having to look, just a way of smothering or getting away from that gnawing feeling? In meditation, then, we're willing to look at it. We need to notice it rather than react to it. To really accept it. And by doing that, we have to put our spirit into it. We have to look not in a dead way, in a kind of perfunctory kind of intellectualizing of it, but a real willingness, a wholehearted acceptance and willingness to bear that, to be with that loneliness and fear. And the kind of patience to do that it takes to be able to do that, is not a stupid patience like a cow out in the meadow, but it is a patience of the spirit. The spirit is encompassing and waiting and embracing. So it isn't a resigned passivity, but it is a very kind of balanced acceptance and receptivity to pain, to fear, to loneliness, to the feeling of alienation and separation. Now, contemplating that, the Buddha gave his Dharma teaching so that we would be able to mindfully, with wisdom, understand the predicament we all have, because we're all in the same predicament, every one of us. We all have the same problem. We've been born. Notice that the people that were never born don't have this problem. But this is the problem of being born as a human being. It's a human problem, and all problems are solvable, isn't it? If it's insolvable, if one can't solve it, then it's not really a problem. It's just the way it is, so we have to accept it. But any problem has a solution. So. Through mindfulness, we begin to look at the way it is. We're not blaming this feeling on anyone. We're not asking it to go away or to be anything other than what it is. But we can reflect on it. And we can understand that just the result of birth means that we have this illusory experience of separation, because we so easily identify with our separateness, the fact that I'm here and you're there, the subject-object experience through consciousness. So when I expect unity on the level of the physical world, it doesn't work. You can't stay united with anything for very long. Because the nature of being born is that you really have to live within a separate form, a seemingly separate form, for a lifetime. And so when we understand that, then we accept it. That's no longer a problem. Because then when you understand it, that problem is disappears. It's been solved. Because we no longer seek unity in the changing conditions that we're born into. We're no longer expecting the bodies and the emotions and the mental conditions to ever be one with anything, because their nature is to arise and cease. They're impermanent. So we chant Sabbe Sankhara Anicca, all conditions are impermanent. That's a way of reminding us of this truth. And therefore we no longer expect these conditions to be satisfactory, to satisfy us, or to take away our loneliness, or to be fulfilled in some permanent way, there's some condition just waiting somewhere around the corner, maybe, or behind the bush, or behind the door, or somewhere. Some condition is there just waiting for me to come by, and that will make me happy forevermore. But without getting cynical or bitter about it, we, with wise reflection, we realize that's just not the way things are. That is not ever going to happen. We might have momentary gratifications and highs and ecstasies through various conditioned experiences, but they change and they dissolve. They die and disappear. And what comes together must separate. So with this reflection, then we make no demand on the sensory world. We don't expect it to be anything other than what it is. And therefore, there is no more problem about the sensory world in regards to our self, our life. The illusion of being separate, then, is from being born, we have to live a seemingly separate existence as an individual being. So in meditation, we're in any kind of religious path is the aspiration toward unity or transcendence, to where there's no longer, where the reality of oneness and totality is realized, and in which there's the sense, the old habits created around the body and conditions of mind are relinquished and abandoned. And then in that experience, in that realization, then there is no fear. There's fearlessness, because there is right understanding. There's no longer does the separation of our bodies, the seeming separateness of them, is no longer an identity. So there's no longer the loneliness or the alienation or the anxiety that is caused from that illusion of me being my body and my thoughts and feelings. Now the pattern, the basic pattern of religion is the pattern of the conditions related relationship to the unconditioned, or the mortal to the immortal. There's the born, the created, the originated, and this arises and ceases, and there is the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, and without that there would not be the created, the born, the originated. In other words, the born is always related to the unborn or the deathless. The death-bound, it relates to the deathless, the mortal to the immortal, the originated with the unoriginated, the created with the uncreated. That's the pattern. And in the separate form of our human birth, we can witness to that pattern. This is what the Buddha, Buddhi is, the Buddha mind, the perfect intellect, the universal intellect, is what we can use to understand and realize this perfect relationship of the arising and ceasing of the conditioned in the unconditioned. Now, in the Vedanta scriptures, Buddhi is the result of the union of Purusha with Prakriti, which is the Purusha is the male, and Prakriti is the female. And they produce buddhi, which is perfect intelligence. So I mean, this pattern is seen in Christianity and is really the foundation of all metaphysics of any form of metaphysics in Hindu or Christian. There is this relationship of the male to the female producing the child, and the child in this case, say on the spiritual plane of that marriage, say having been born as a human being, then this buddhi is our refuge. It's universal wisdom and pure intellect, which we use to understand the way things are within the limitation of our human state, with our own karmic patterns, with the seeming individuality and separateness as a result of birth, we have this opportunity by tuning in to this universal intelligence. Now, being in the form we're in, when we connect to Buddhi or to Buddha, the Buddhist or the Buddha, there's always been a Buddha. Before Gautama the Buddha, there were unknown. No, there were 28 Buddhas, and before that, they've given up trying to conceive of any before that. But the first Buddha or second Buddha, who knows what age they lived in Atlantis or Lemuria? Because Gautama the Buddha lived 2,533 years ago, and that's a long time in our terms, isn't it? That's a long time. When we think of India, 2,533 years ago, it's Even the American Civil War to us is ancient history. But the, in fact, the Second World War for most of you is old, ancient history. But Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, being born in the sal grove in Lumpini, and getting enlightened under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya and so forth. This was such a powerful experience in the human karma that we're still talking about it to this day. And I've been talking about nothing else for years. Now, Buddhas there are 28 or so. Was Gautama the 28th, or he was the 28th? Yes. So. And Maitreya is the next one. Supposed to be the next one, and there are already claimers for that position. I don't know how many Maitreyas I've heard of when I went to England 13 years ago. There was a Japanese monk living in Birmingham or someplace like that that said he was Maitreya. But everybody told me that before he was Maitreya, he was a lot better teacher. After he became Maitreya, nobody could stand him. He disappeared somewhere. I never heard of him for years. And you know, there's claimants for that. Well, then there was the Benjamin Cream predicament. That was what, in 1984. In the London newspapers, they had these amazing advertisements, like a whole double page, you know, of a London newspaper, like the Telegraph or the Guardian, and they'd have these the Lord Maitreya is coming and will announce his he arrived in England on the 19th of July, 1977, it said. And he's living somewhere, he's hiding away somewhere, and will announce himself on a certain day, which was what?
June 21st.
He has a good memory. June 21st and 1984. So this was everybody. Of course, the British character tends to be kind of negative and cynical about these things. But these were very impressive advertisements. So it made you wonder. You know, that must cost a lot of money to rent all that space in a London newspaper, and then this man Benjamin Cream was going around Britain. Talking about this, and I even received special letters and all kinds of information on this, and they were really pushing it. So during that time, June 21st, we were all kind of waiting to see what would happen, and then finally the information kept kind of saying, well, we found Maitreya. And he's somewhere in the Brick Lane, which is a rather grotty part of London. And so then the day came, and we're all waiting. And by this time, the British had seemed to become completely disinterested in it, and they were having all these football games, and everybody, the television, the news was all aimed at these football matches, and nobody was really very much interested in Maitreya's arrival. And so Benjamin Cream was really upset, and then several people in Brick Lane claimed to be the Maitreya Buddha. And so it was a great fizzle, and it was And it was a laughing stock, and Benjamin Cream didn't show his face for years. I think he's back on the war path. But if that's the right... But this is how this looking for the Maitreya as the next Buddha, or the Messiah, isn't it? This Maitreya Buddha is a combination of Jesus and Maitreya, because they're making out that he is the joyous, loving force in the universe, and it's a very attractive symbol indeed, Maitreya Buddha, and the Messiah, or the return of the Christ. So the mind starts thinking, you know, wouldn't it be nice if Maitreya Buddha would come, or Christ would come back and set everything right, because we've really made a mess of it here. And we really need somebody like that to straighten it out, because obviously United Nations can't do it. and we couldn't see any possible way of solving the world's problems except through some kind of miracle or the coming of these future saviors. So many people's minds went out in hope that this would happen. And many people, of course, were disappointed on the 21st of June, because it was such a kind of pathetic experience where these two Maitreyas were fighting over, quarreling about who was the real one. And that's not very inspiring, is it? They're not any better than we are. So, contemplating that, though, one, you know, even I thought it would be nice. It'd really be nice if Maitreya would come at this time, and that 1984 in England, people were quite frightened, because there were all these kind of rumors and possibilities for war, and the peace movement people, and all this were beginning to really, you know, there was so much pessimism and fear that there was going to be some kind of nuclear war. And of course Europe is the most logical place for that to happen. At least that's what it seemed like back in 1984. So it would be nice if some savior would come along and save the day. And then I thought that this is very much the general development, emotional development of most human beings, isn't it? Where we make a mess of things, and then we want mummy and daddy to come and straighten it out for us, save us, because we've got ourselves into a corner, and we want somebody to come and save me. So we start crying, Mommy or Daddy, come and help me, save me. And this seemed to me to be a rather pathetic state of the human heart, where we weren't willing to do the things in order to create the situations where the problems could be solved. When we made a mess, we still felt we wanted God to come and make it right for us. So in this way, say, there's still this exteriorization, this exoterism, in which we see something, some outer force has to come and clean up the mess. A macrocosmic celestial father or mother, or some savior coming from outside, coming in to help us. Now the emphasis on Buddhist meditation then is giving up that expectation or that demand. It's like growing up, isn't it? We're emotionally willing to grow out of that demand and expectation. Because we realize we can clean up our own mess. We have this ability to clean up the mess we've made of our lives ourselves. We don't have to call in somebody else to do it. And so when we realize this, then our spirit is in the form, because we're no longer just a kind of degenerate form hoping that something will come along and inspire me and give me a high, give me a buzz. But we actually can generate power, and we that spirit is something that all of us have, but which we need to use, we need to trust, we need to develop that. Just in sitting posture. I mean, we can sit without any effort and just kind of fall over or collapse or slouch down. Or we can put the spirit into the form where we raise the body up. We fill the body out with our spirit, with our life force. We bring it to its fullness, just by willing it to be that way. We can bring ourselves to do that. We can investigate, we can look into the way things are. We can put our attention on to any object, onto any sensation. We can investigate it, we can contemplate this sensation. Say, with the Buddhist teachings, we do have help from outside, don't we? As we chant, the Buddha is our teacher, our helper. He helps us, he guides us. But it's not an external. We're not praying to some external Buddha, but using the teaching that he left by bringing it to life within our own body and mind. So that the spirit is, we're breathing life, we're breathing our spirit into the form. And that is the Sangha, the one who practices in the right way. Then the Sangha, the tradition, has a spirit. That's what one felt with Rungpa Cha in Thailand, that here was a monastery and a teacher. There was a vital spiritual quality about the place. It wasn't just an ordinary old monastery where people were just doing things out of habit and out of belief and superstition, but it had a real spirit to it as a monastery, because the monks were encouraged to use the teachings of the Buddha to investigate, to look into the Dhamma, to see the way it is. The biggest problem most of us face is with doubt, isn't it? It's very difficult our minds are so conditioned with thoughts, proliferating thoughts, that we're so used to thinking and grasping these thoughts and believing these thoughts that inevitably they take us to doubt and uncertainty. How do we know anatta is true, no self? Sabbe sankhara and all conditions are impermanent, they're all unsatisfactory. How do we know that? How do we know that anything I'm saying is true? Maybe I'm just deluded. Maybe Buddhism isn't true. Maybe it's a false religion. Or maybe the teacher is deluded. Could be. And then there are various others, kind of Buddhist groups that say Theravada is an inferior form. It doesn't take you to complete enlightenment because it's Hinayana, and then you start. Yeah, it's probably, it might be true. And then the Christians come along and say it's a satanic religion. They worship idols and so forth, and then all kinds of criticisms and comments are made in the mind that still, when we're caught in our thoughts, then we tend to, will always be what people say, what people in authority say, or what other people, even people without any authority say, affects our minds. And so we get caught in hesitation, doubt, uncertainty, insecurity. The self-doubt is really a major leap in consciousness to get beyond the self-doubt. Am I ready? Can I do it? I'm not, I've got so many problems, and the way we tend to perceive ourselves as being hopeless or inferior or incapable or not ready, or maybe, it's impossible for me. It might be maybe Ajahn Sumedho, but me, I don't think I can do it. These are self-doubts. So the doubt about oneself, about the tradition, about the teacher. Now, what I recommend in the monasteries is, because this happens a lot in monastic life, because monks and nuns go through various phases of inspiration and desperation. And then these doubts come into their minds, and then they hear about other things happening, there's a lot of information about, and a lot of interesting things, and new ideas, new religions, new groups. There's always this idea, Buddhism is an old religion. It would probably work for people in India 2,533 years ago. I mean, it was for that kind of mind. But we've evolved since then. And Britain or America, different. I mean, there's certainly people have, totally different than they were in India. So Buddha's religion probably is out of date, and then there's these new religions. Well, that seems sensible. I mean, certainly we see old things as being maybe appropriate for a certain time and place, but then they get old and they wear out, and therefore we need new ones. There's this tremendous emphasis in America about making Buddhism into an American Buddhism. You hear that in the Inquiring Mind a lot, about making Buddhism American. We want American Buddhism. And in Britain, there's that we want people with, I've heard so many people say, we want British Buddhism. And this is a common attitude when you're taking, say, a religion from an Asian country, people want to adapt it and make it into fit their own cultural standards, which seems sensible too, doesn't it? If you're going to bring Buddhism to America, you want to make it reasonable and presentable and likable and popular and something that masses of Americans will like, and something that doesn't, that we can feel at ease with, because we don't feel at ease doing things the way Asian people do things. We feel a bit tense, and it makes us nervous to do those Asian customs. And so we want to Americanize it, and so it fits into what we feel comfortable with. And this also, I challenge this way of thinking, because when Buddhism has managed to survive without the Americans for 2000, and there's a kind of the fact that it has a kind of force and a thrust to it in its traditional form, when the traditional form is tampered with too much, I think it loses its power. Its strength is weakened, because in just noticing people's adaptations of Buddhism in the West, they're lacking something. Because the one thing, people tend to take what they want. We have a kind of conceit. Americans have a terrible conceit about we know what's good for us. And we don't want any of that Asian hocus pocus, because we are beyond that. We're better than that. And we know what we need out of these. We just need vipassana, that's all. We want to practice vipassana. They do it in Zen, don't they? We just want Zen. We don't want Buddhism. We don't want Buddha Dhamma. We want Zen. And in England, you meet people who call themselves Zenists. You say, we're not Buddhists, we're Zenists. And people here say we're sitters. This is the new religion. Now, tradition, with all its seemingly, because traditions do get, can, as I've said before, become without any spirit. They can be just perfunctory ways of doing things. But they can also, we can breathe the life into a tradition. And this is what we're doing within this tradition. We're trying to do this. We're putting ourselves into the form. We're not trying to bend the form and make it what I want, because I feel that in many ways, when I first ordained as a monk, there were many things within the tradition that I didn't particularly like in Thailand. And I was quite critical of a lot of things when at Ajahn Chah's monastery, even though I thought it's a really good place, but I know ways of making it better. I unfortunately was wise enough not to mention this to anybody. I didn't dare say that to Ajahn Chah. But thoughts like that did occur to me, that I really knew how to make this place better. But over the years, by learning to fit within and stay within the limits of the tradition, I began to see what conceit really is, and how really I never thought of myself in that term as being a conceited person, but when I was learning to live within the restraints of a traditional form, my conceit really became apparent, because there was a lot of resistance, a lot of stubbornness I could see, and just being born in this country and educated here, there's a lot we just take for granted, that we somehow know better than anyone else. And so this conceit could be witnessed to, could be recognized for what it was. Now, when a tradition, you take it even with everything. It's not something you emasculate. You don't cut bits off like this image out here in the crucifix, isn't it? Kind of where there's no head, feet, arms, or genital organs. it's a kind of, maybe that's the Americanization of Christianity. Don't quote me on that. a tradition has a force to it that it's like a a pod or a shell in which the seeds are protected. It can carry, if there's no shell, no pod, then the seeds are scattered and lost. But when there is, then it is a protection for them. It's not what you eat or what nourishes you, but it definitely allows to protect what is the essence, what is essential, what is truly nourishing. So the tradition is, tradition means to hand down. It's something that comes down to us. So the Buddha established a tradition 2,533 years ago, and this has been, and what we regard as that tradition was preserved within the scriptures, the Tripitaka, and very much we try to live within the restraint of the discipline the Buddha established, the rules we keep, and our way of life, say as monks and as nuns, is very much to live within the allowed relationships and the form that was established in what we call the Vinaya discipline. That is that holds it together. You find in our community in England, it holds together well as a community because everybody in it agrees to live within that restraint. It's not my idea. It's not Ajahn Sumedho's idea of what Buddhism should be, and it's not Ajahn Chah's Buddhism. It's what was established, as best we know, by the Lord Buddha himself. So no matter even if we don't particularly see the value or appreciate the whole thing, at times we still conform and live within that restraint. And by doing that, then we begin to understand the value of restraint and limitation, not as an oppression, but as a way to compose and collect and not be scattered about, not be thrown about and all over the place. Because when you stay in one place, or when you limit your abilities to certain things, and so that just what is essential for enlightenment is the main goal, and the purpose of our life, then of course we don't create a lot of social problems in a community. We accept the limits and the relationships established. So then we can actually practice the Dhamma, because we're not fighting and vying with each other and revolting and rebelling and doing all these kind of activities. We're not trying to seek each other out. We're not trying to form romantic attachments or emotional attachments to each other. The purpose is to realize truth. So that is the guiding star, the goal of our life. And even though there are attractions and so forth as a part of living in a community, there's attractions and there's repulsions and the personality clashes and so forth, just like anywhere else. But these are not really made into problems, because if they're wise, if the monks and nuns use wisdom, then they more or less see it for what it is and don't create it into anything, into any big thing. They learn how to let go of their conceit, their views, their desires, their opinions, not by suppressing, but by reflecting and realizing the way of letting go and the way of non-attachment. Because the form, the limitation is a moral limitation. We have moral rights. There's been a lot of problems in Buddhist communities and Buddhist groups, just on the level of morality, where the teacher seems to have such power as to to, say, commit immoral acts towards the students. So that this, and students, people that have faith and believe in a teacher, will more or less do what the teacher wants. And so if the teacher is not morally based, then the students are exploited by that teacher, or misused and abused by the teacher. And that only leads to the problems of factions and mistrust and resentments and all the problems that come from that kind of behavior. Now in Sangha, our commitment is to, there's no way even the most senior, most important and respected monk, bhikkhu, can ask any one of the members of the community or the lay community to commit any kind of immoral act. And if we do, then it's your duty to refuse. Even though you might think you might admire me and respect me and think that I know everything, if I should suggest you do something against the moral precepts, then it's your duty to say, no, you are wrong. That's your moral right, is to, you have that, you need to know what your rights are as a Buddhist. And the rights are based on these moral precepts. And this is to be really made very clear that an enlightened master, or whatever you think somebody is, that has no right to ask anyone to break the precepts. And if he does, then your duty is to refuse. We can also admonish each other. Like if I'm start going off a bit, then it's Venerable Amaro's duty to admonish me. And then it's my duty to obey and live under the restraint, the proper restraint of our discipline. So, I mean, even though Venerable Amaro's junior monk, junior to me, it's his duty to help me if I start going off the track. And vice versa, if he goes off the track, then it's my duty to help him, to admonish him. And so that this is a way of this mutual admonishment helps us to be able to see ourselves. We need that kind of feedback, because sometimes when you're in a position as a teacher, and you have an aura of a kind of sanctity around you, and you've been given permission, and you've given some kind of transmission, and you're considered a Dharma heir, or you're considered the first Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, or people have all these high expectations of you. If there's no proper admonishment available, if everybody goes along in the state of awe and adoration, then that person is not can really go off the track, because one starts assuming that you can do anything. There's a law of feeling that an enlightened person can do anything, and there's a law of feeling that an enlightened person can break all the moral laws, and it's just great fun, you know. Thumb your nose at morality, and it just shows that you're not attached to it, and you're liberated from it. So that appeals to many people, because that's like thumbing your nose at authority and making fun of the old kind of prudes and straight-laced, dreary types of people that purse their lips and go naughty and bad and immoral. So we all have like to kind of make fun of the uptight prude, and feel we aren't that way. Look at the way we can just flaunt the rules, and we don't care. But that isn't, that is a rebellion. That's still a very immature attitude, isn't it? We went through that years ago, where you wanted to break the rules and shock your parents and be daring and outrageous. But one doesn't want to live a life being outrageous, especially when you're 56 years old. So the breathing the spirit into the form is an act of love. It's not a stupid conformity or fear of being punished for breaking rules. It's not blind attachment to moral precepts and principles and all that. That doesn't put life into the form. It makes the form even deader. I mean, just fear-conditioned creatures, just obeying out of fear, is not an inspiring sight, and certainly doesn't arouse any inspiration in others. But the ability, when we love the form, when we put our heart into what we're doing, into the restraint and into the practice, then there is a Buddha Rupa, or a Buddha form. So the Buddha form is like this. You see, this is the Buddha form. The human form, isn't it? It's not a Martian, and it's not a Devadar, it's not an angel. Even though the flame from the head, it's merely symbolic. Don't take it too literally. That's religious symbols. You can do that with religious symbols because they are symbolic. They don't have to be anatomically accurate. But notice the presence of that form. This is a very beautiful Buddha Rupa. So the face is the face. If you look at Buddha Rupas, most all of them, their face has a serene look. The eyes are open; they're not shut, and they're sitting straight and they're alert. And this one is the touching the earth mudra, like this. So this particular mudra, the story behind that is that. Before the Buddha was enlightened, he was sitting under the Bodhi tree. And this is an allegory. Sitting under the Bodhi tree, and then all the forces of Mara came to attack him. And all these forces, like in temples in Bangkok, some of the old temples have these beautiful murals in the temples of the forces of Mara attacking the Buddha before his enlightenment. They're all coming at him in various forms of fearsome expressions and dragons and the most horrendous things and tempting sights, all there to try to delude the Buddha. And he's sitting there, his eyes open, he's not frightened. His eyes are open, he sees all this. And then these forms say, "Who do you think you are that you can sit under the Bodhi tree? Get out of there. You don't belong there. You're deluded." I'm going on like this. That's the place of enlightenment. The Bodhi tree is like the place of enlightenment or the axis mundi. It's the place of enlightenment. So the Buddha, who wasn't quite yet the Buddha then, but just on the verge, said, he touched the earth and he said, "Let the earth be my witness." So he touched the earth. Now the earth is a symbol for the female and Mother Earth. And so this is like he, before he could be enlightened, he had to get permission from Mother. In other words, the female energy, the forces, had to approve that this wasn't just a presumptuous act, that this wasn't just an egotistical thing of some precocious little child that's acting badly. So it was the request, let Mother Earth be my witness. So then Mother Earth came forth, and with compassion she flooded, water is the element of compassion, she flooded the forces of Mara and they all disappeared. From her hair, they have a monument in, or a kind of shrine to Mother Earth, or Nang Torani in Thai, in Bangkok, near the Senam Luang, in which there's this female figure with her hair and water, is a fountain with water coming out of it, so that the water's coming out of the hair, she's squeezing her hair, then this flood floods away the forces of Mara, which is Mother Earth saying, he has the right to be where he is. He has the right to be enlightened. So then Siddhartha Gautama, the ascetic Gautama, was left alone. Mara left, and then he meditated, and then through his meditations and through his understanding of the dependent origination, he realized the truth. So this is like repelling the forces of Mara. Let the earth be my witness. So this symbol also means that, like in our own, we have to come to terms with our earth body. We have to accept, we have to ask permission, and that means that we need to respect just the body we have, the earthbound body, the earthbound state of our birth, before we can dare to be enlightened or assume that we can be enlightened. So it's not just a presumptuous kid saying, "I want to be enlightened," and then trying to become enlightened out of a willful act. But it is a wise understanding of how things operate. So, say, in our earthbound state as human beings, we have to learn how to respect and keep our bodies within a restraint, so that they're not being abused or misused or used for evil purposes or exploited by ourselves or others. And that's what morality is about. Is the sila is a way of respecting your body and mind. So with that basis of morality, then we have the right to be enlightened, because that's like the Mother Earth. Then Mother Earth gives us the right to be enlightened. Now look how much we have exploited, and just like the most dreadful, horrid kind of children abuse Mother Earth. Just the human population. We've just tried to, just like you see, like horrible little children just constantly at their mother's, you know, not giving her a moment's rest until she's an absolute wreck. And she's ready to have a nervous breakdown. And she can't, because she's got to take care of these brats. And so I think human beings are very much on that level right now. We're like brats. badly trained, selfish, insensitive little kids that don't live in the right way, don't behave properly. And therefore, we create confusion and we pollute and we make a mess of everything. And then we want somebody to come, we want Maitreya to come and save us. So this is a very important reflection for you to consider, the need to restrain action and speech within the moral limitation, as in lay people with the five precepts. This to keep within those limitations means that you are living in a way in which enlightenment is possible for you. But until you do that, you're like a presumptuous kid who's just trying to get enlightened as an act of will. No matter if any master has certified you as a Dharma heir, it doesn't matter. If you still cannot restrain yourself within that limit, you're not worthy of sitting under the Bodhi tree. You're not worthy to sit in the place of enlightenment. And so the forces of Mara destroy you. You Mother Earth will not rescue you, will not give you permission. So the forces of Mara will take you over. In a tradition, we don't like the idea of British Buddhism or American Buddhism. All this is another kind of conceit we have to transcend. We're not trying to make Buddhism into something we want or something American, but we're learning how to live within the tradition of that the Buddha left us and not try to make it into something else. So when we talk about American Buddhism, it's really not the right way to talk. I mean, as far as if you're really aim is to be enlightened, we don't want to make it American. Americans need to learn how to live within the restraint of a tradition, not try to make a tradition into an American thing. And this I found very helpful with me in my own experience in learning to conform and contain myself within a tradition and in an Asian country where I had to really put forth that kind of effort to restrain myself and live and adapt and conform, but not as a blind, stupid act, but as a way of training in which I could actually begin to see myself and my conceit and my fears and my desires. Because the limitation of a tradition is like a mirror. We can see ourselves because we're not acting from our own desires anymore, our own views. We can see our views then when we're not following our own views and our own opinions. We can see our views as a reflected object rather. Where if we just follow our views and opinions, we don't see them anymore because we're attached to them. So we need restraint, we need limitation and forms in order to reflect, because if we don't have any, if it's all based on high-minded ideas, then we end up with no reflection. We're like trying to start out from the top. When we're not at the top, we're pretending, we're trying to get to the top when we're still at the bottom. And no matter how hard we try to reach to the top and get there, we can't, because we don't know where we are yet. We haven't accepted the limitation and the place we're in. We're trying to grasp the star rather than use it as a guide. Now these are my reflections on tradition, which I'm presenting to you. I'm not trying to convince you of anything, because you're certainly free agents to be whatever you want to be. But I oftentimes feel that American especially is, because we tend to be anti-traditional. We're a country based on ideals rather than traditions. So we tend to suspect and even regard tradition as something wrong or something we don't want. But tradition is something that can be used. And it's a whole thing. We like breathing the life into the tradition. When you get good bhikkhus and good nuns, enlightened bhikkhus, enlightened nuns in a community, then that whole tradition is alive. It has a spirit to it. It has a radiance to it. Then you can say, oh, Buddhism is so so alive. And but yet, if you see some monasteries that I've seen, you would say, totally dead religion. Just like Christianity. You can go to some churches where it's just dead, and other churches have a spirit to them because people are actually practicing. And they have that radiance that comes from the practice, from right practice. Then after the Buddha's enlightenment, Brahmasahampati said, you must teach for the welfare of those with only little dust in your hearts, because after his enlightenment he thought, what I've learned is so subtle that I don't think anybody's going to understand it, so I won't teach. And then the Brahmasahampati, which is like the symbol of the Divine Father, the Divine Forces, the Father, gave permission to teach, encouraged the Buddha to expound the Dhamma. So these forces of mother and father, these are symbols. Don't take them literally. But this is very much the value of religious symbolism. It's the relationship of male to female, and also the experiences we have within our own spiritual life. So Mother Earth and the Divine Father give birth to the Buddha, or through that proper union, then there is the connection to universal intelligence, because Buddhi is the symbol for universal intelligence or intellect, wisdom. So my advice is not to wait for Maitreya Buddha. Or the return of the Christ, but to do it yourself. Don't wait. Don't be Don't wait for somebody else to do it. Do it yourself. And this is when you think, has anyone else done it? That doesn't matter. You do it. And you say, well, I don't think I can do it if no one else has done it. And there you're stuck with the self-doubt again. So you can ask yourself, well, what if nobody else has done it since Gautama the Buddha? Then that still shouldn't discourage you, because you can do it. So yes, how many enlightened beings are here, or how many arahants are there in the world, and is Ajahn Chah an arahant, or how evolved is Ajahn Sumedho, and all this kind of thing? You're still waiting for the Maitreya, or you're asking somebody else to enlighten you. Really, you want to see the proof before you'll take the step. But that's not really how it works. It's an act of faith, and once we start, we just keep going. And no matter how many fall away and become disillusioned, it doesn't matter, because we can still keep going. And I remember in Thailand years ago, I'd get all this news about these scandals in America and in Europe of gurus falling off their pedestals and roshis and all this thing, and you'd get feeling quite depressed by it, because you kind of would feel that before you were inspired by some of these people, and then they fell, and they seemed to, and then. Everybody criticized them, and then your own doubts. Well, you know, nobody can do it, I guess. So then I asked myself, now what if Ajahn Chah suddenly announced to me, said, Sumedho, Buddhism is all a farce, it's a big lie. It's better to disrobe and get married and settle down, have a family. What if the Dalai Lama suddenly eloped with a film star? What if all our heroes, all our great teachers and idols suddenly just fell down and cracked and crashed and shattered? What would you do? Well, the right thing to do would be just keep going on. Don't let that cause you any problem. Because are we in it for just because we're still very much our spirit and inspiration is still dependent upon somebody else being something for us, or have we matured to the level where we can be that ourselves, be that and be the knowing and see and realize truth and be free from delusion? And we can't, it's unfair to expect that from anyone else. I will not make that demand on anyone. I don't expect anybody in the world to do it or demand that I see somebody who's done it, because I realize it's something I must do myself, something that I can do. So then, this is how it helps you to think about getting beyond the self-doubt, where you're, because as a personality, I certainly went through a lot of doubts about, felt very worthless and unable and inadequate and incapable of doing anything like that, and not daring. And who do you think you are that you think you could ever? And the Maras come at you like that. Who do you think you are? You know, if so-and-so can't do it, what makes you think you can do it? And you, who do you think you are, Sumato? You're overestimating yourself. And all these nasty voices go on, but don't believe them, because it's just the forces of Mara testing you out. Because this is like the Buddha, let the earth be my witness. My restraint, my intention is completely mature now. I am ready for enlightenment. I'm ready, and I request permission for this from the mother that gave me birth, from the earth. And then the earth responded, said, yes, this Gotama has the right to be enlightened. And so that's the result of his moral restraint, his goodness, his generosity, his kindness, his development of virtue and goodness was complete. And so he was no longer, say, it wasn't then a willful act or an overestimation. Then after one has insights and understands Dhamma, then more and more we oftentimes don't feel like there's a strong interest in just living a peaceful life away from the confusions and problems of the marketplace. But there's also the compassionate father, the kind father who says, teach for the welfare of those with only a little dust. There are beings who are ready for the teaching. They only have the little dust in their eyes. So that the teaching is then can be, we're not becoming teachers, or we're not trying to, we're not becoming teachers out of an act of will, out of some overestimation of ourselves, or I want to go tell you where it's at, and I want to be your teacher, as a conceit, but it's the willingness to share what one has learned from the practice of the Dhamma. Because one realizes that there are beings with only a little dust in their eyes and that will benefit from this teaching of the Dhamma. As disciples of the Buddha, then we have that right when we understand that those teachings, we have the right to teach them, and we have the compassion to try to make these teachings and available to people and give opportunities and occasions for people to practice. So we set up monasteries and little Buddhist groups and meditation groups and give retreats and give public talks and have summer work camp, summer children camps or family camps and all kinds of things we get involved with. But it's the willingness of people who have had insight into those teachings and appreciate that and want to share that and give the other people who haven't heard yet those teachings an opportunity to hear them and to practice. And to encourage those beings to develop the foundation in which enlightenment is possible. And that foundation is in the development of virtue and restraint and morality, in which we have the right to sit in the spot of enlightenment, the center of the universe, the axis mundi, the boat under the Bodhi tree. So I offer this for your reflection and contemplation for this evening.